Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, April 17th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we'll be discussing the local top stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from WCAI Sam Houghton and Eve Zuckoff, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent, Ethan Genter at the Cape Cod Times. We'll hear from Jack Spillane in New Bedford at the Standard Times, speak with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, talk with Mike Dean up at the State House, and we'll finish off by checking in with WCAI's Jeanette Barnes. Now a look at the news around the region. WCAI Sam Houghton starts us off in these busy times with an overview of the latest numbers and information on the local coronavirus response. Good morning, Sam.
Morning, Steve.
Sam, it is Friday morning. Bring us up to date with the numbers that we have for the week here.
Yeah, so this week we saw sobering benchmark. Wednesday, 1,000 people were reported to have died from the virus. That's across the whole state.
We surpassed 1,000 people in the state overall, not 1,000 people died on Wednesday, right?
Right. Sorry. The tally now is over 1,200. So that's more, I think, important to know. It's more than double from Friday last week. Governor Baker also announced Wednesday the state is officially in a surge. There are over 3,600 patients in Massachusetts hospitals with the virus. That was on Wednesday. In terms of confirmed cases, there are now 32,000 across the state. Put that in perspective, we had about 20,000 last Friday. So not quite double, but significantly more. And then locally, there are 550 cases now on the Cape. That's about 100 more than where we were last week. So not a huge spike, but 18 people have died on the Cape. Then in Bristol County, about 1,600 people have tested positive. There were about 1,000 positive cases last week, so a substantial increase there. We learned that 7 people in New Bedford have died, and 3 have died in Fall River.
Let's talk about the islands. Against this backdrop of all these rising numbers, the islands have actually been an unusual sign of optimism.
Yeah, that's kind of a big story we've been following. We listened in on a press conference hosted by the Martha's Vineyard Hospital. And they started, they're cautiously optimistic. They've had 9 straight days now without a new case. Nantucket's had 13 straight days. But that optimism comes with a real warning not to be complacent. There's a desire in the islands to end the ban on construction and landscaping. The Vineyard Hospital CEO, Denisha Pisi, is saying to use caution when opening the islands back up to business. It's a small community there, and just one positive case, she says, can lead to a surge. They only have, limited resources at their hospital, so they're worried about that kind of surge. And when you start bringing business back to the island, it can be nearly impossible to keep kind of social distancing practices in place. You have several workers living in, one home and several people on one single job site. And so she has basically pleaded with Fleckman on the Vineyard not to allow construction to go on.
Sam, another big story this week, there's been changes in how the state is reporting statistics on COVID-19.
Yeah, we found out the number of positive tests of the virus is now being reported town by town. The state has been leaving that up to each individual administration for a while now, but some towns have been reporting numbers while others haven't. I know, like Bourne had not been reporting their numbers. The town administrator there said he didn't want to create panic, but at the same time, he didn't want to make people feel complacent that they saw that of individual stats. The state's website now has a breakdown of each town. Unfortunately, it's only updated once a week. But also new this week, the state has been giving a daily update on admitted patients within hospitals. For example, you can see that as of yesterday afternoon, 20 people had been admitted to Falmouth Hospital, with 4 there in the ICU.
That is WCAI Sam Houghton bringing us up to date with all the latest numbers. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
Around 40 detainees with the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, have been released from a Bristol County facility after four staff members tested positive for COVID-19. WCAI's Eve Zuckoff has been reporting on this and is with us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, sir, Steve.
Eve, you spoke with someone who was just released from the facility. Tell us about what you heard.
That's right. I spoke with one man, 45-year-old Julio Figueroa Morales, and first he told me about the conditions on the inside. He said, the men in his unit sleep in bunk beds, so there was no more than 3 feet between them. Social distancing was not possible for them. And so he said, he had this line where he says, one guy gets sick, everybody gets sick. So it's worth noting no detainees or inmates in Bristol County have tested positive for COVID-19 as of 2 days ago, according to the sheriff's office. But the fear was really that nurses, correctional officers, staff would go home, contract the virus, and then bring it in. And that's exactly what happened. In Julio Figueroa Morales' case, he's a diabetic and received an insulin injection from a nurse who very shortly after tested positive for COVID-19. So he's been monitoring his symptoms.
What did you hear from the Bristol County Corrections people about this? What are they saying about what they were doing to try to keep people safe?
Yeah, so face masks have been distributed to everyone in the facility. Staff are required to wear them. They also, all staff, when they come in each day, have their temperatures taken before work. If it's above 100, they are sent home and need a doctor's clearance before they can come back. And also, the office is saying, we are worried about public safety in terms of the release of around 40 detainees. So they've created a prisoner alert release system to notify residents of any criminal charges or convictions against the released detainees.
I want to switch gears here for a moment. You reported also on the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe this week. Now, all tribal members are eligible for COVID-19 tests at a Mashpee drive-through site. This is regardless of symptoms. Access to testing has been fraught for many people across the region. How is this possible for the Mashpee Wampanoag? Tell us.
Yeah, that's really the question, and that's what makes this kind of special. So the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe said it's actually the first tribe in the country to receive direct federal assistance for pandemic response. Federal lawmakers have also established a separate $8 million stabilization fund to help tribal governments deal with COVID-19 and pandemic response, but that seems to be rolling out much more slowly. But this is because the Mashpee tribe secured funds through an emergency declaration that they submitted to FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and they were awarded money that came along with that emergency declaration. That money has gone straight to the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe Indian Health Services Unit, where they have set up kind of a medical tent outside, and they've been able to buy enough test kits to test any person who's a member of any federally recognized tribe for COVID-19 at no cost.
And what have you heard about how this is going?
Yeah, so Wednesday was the first day of the real rollout, though testing had been available on a limited basis for a few weeks. So in the weeks prior to this past Wednesday, 26 people had been tested. Two were positive, three results were pending. It was a slow rollout on Wednesday. Only four people came through the test site because many people still have to kind of register. But the most important thing I would say I heard from the emergency management director of the tribe was that, yes, of course there's worry here, and it's pretty amazing that they have this money and these tests to do this. But more than anything, the tribe has survived so many attacks over the years, including widespread illness. Back in the 1600s, when white settlers first came to the United States, first came to America, at least. So I was told, we're getting through this pandemic the same way our ancestors were able to get through the last one.
That is WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
The Steamship Authority has announced that the pier in Oak Bluffs needs immediate repair. It's news that has sparked some tempers in the town with concerns over the coming summer. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us to talk about just that. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm going well, George. Thanks. It's all different. I'm talking to you from my home, and I'm guessing you're at your home, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's a different world we're dealing with, that's for sure.
George, this all seems to have come to a head at a meeting of the Dukes County Commissioners this week. Tell us about this meeting and what happened here.
Yeah, so earlier in the week, we had reported on an issue with the Oak Bluffs Pier. That's where the Steamship Authority has two ports over on the Vineyard. Vineyard Haven is the main one, but Oak Bluffs opens in the summertime, and that takes about 50% of the traffic away from Vineyard Haven into Oak Bluffs. And, you know, it's welcomed for the people in Vineyard Haven, because if all the ferries were to go through there, traffic would be just unbelievable. It's already bad going through Five Corners. So it's an important port. Well, come to find out, there are some real structural issues with the Oak Bluffs Pier. And it came to light that, you know, the Steamship Authority may not be able to get those repairs done in time for the season. Now, we don't even know how much of a season there'll be, how many people are going to want to go to Martha's Vineyard, of course. All of that is, you know, still up in the air. Still, officials in Oak Bluffs want to be ready if they're able to open up and be able to invite tourists to the island and seasonal residents to the island. They want to be prepared for it. Finding out that the pier has all these issues, I think it's 21 pilings that are at issue, according to an engineering report. And there's also some issues with it's 35 pilings, and some issues with the decking as well. Brian Packish, who's the chairman of the Board of Selectmen, this was the straw, he told me, that broke the camel's back. He is demanding that the Steamship Authority replace the general manager, who's Robert Davis. He's saying that, you know, they've dealt with a lot of other issues, broken down ferries a couple of years ago, and some other issues, cost overruns, but this is it. And then at that Dukes County meeting that you talked about, Jim Malkin, who's the new representative for the island, told officials that this could really, COVID-19 and the lack of customers could really undermine the whole ferry service. They're looking at a $50 million deficit, which is,
George,
is kind of
million.
Staggering.
Yes, yeah. $50 million is huge. You can't even really comprehend how they could be looking at a deficit like that and keep functioning.
Yeah, the only person who can relate to that, I think, these days is Tom Brady. I mean, honestly, $50 million is just, you know, something that none of us can really imagine. But the traffic is way down. The SSA has reduced its service. When they are traveling back and forth, a lot of it is still commerce, trucks going to the island to bring goods and services. We had an employee who was on the boat the day it stormed earlier this week. He was the only walk-on passenger.
Yeah.
So it's just amazing.
It is amazing. Malkin talked a little bit about an idea about trying to get the pier operational by June, despite all of that.
Right. So there's a meeting coming up of the Steamship Authority Board this coming Tuesday. Should be an interesting meeting, by the way. First time we'll hear from Robert Davis about this whole issue. And what he has asked Davis and the administration of the Steamship Authority to come up with is some sort of a safe plan to get the pier ready in time for the season. Whether that can be done or not, they're in consultation with engineers now to see what they can do to make sure that that pier is both functional and safe when the time comes.
Briefly, I want to ask you about another story. We have just about a minute here. The Ag Fair announced that it's not going to happen this year, and this is a real break with tradition.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is this would have been the 159th year for the Ag Fair, the only other time that it has not gone on for a season was in during World War II. So, I mean, this is something that family after family after family, this is a tradition for them, those with long, deep roots to the island. And it's something that visitors like. And it, you know, talk about celebrities coming to the island. Well, this is the place where you might sneak a peek at Seth Meyers because of just the two and bringing their dogs to the dog show and going to the pig races and the skillet toss. It's just a really, it's a slice of Americana. And this summer, it won't be there. There are some organizations that are holding out hope that they'll be able to have, for example, the fireworks in Oak Bluffs. Mm-hmm. Right now, they're saying that's an August event put on by the Firefighters Association. Right now, they're saying it's too soon to cancel that. So some people are holding out hope that they'll be able to have events, and others are actually looking at ways to do things virtually if they're not able to hold their events. So hang on tight. You know, we're hoping for some summer season on the island. It's just going to be a different one, to be sure.
George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Thanks. Stay well, everyone.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. In Chatham, a new fund aims to help those most in need as a result of the pandemic. It's just one of a number of efforts in the community to pull together and help each other out. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us now with the story. Hiya, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, start by telling us about the Chatham Coronavirus Impact Fund. Who's behind it and what's the goal here?
Sure. Well, as we've talked about this year a lot, Chatham has been wrestling with the issue of retaining a diverse population with young families and seniors and everybody in between. There's a group of Chatham residents who are really concerned that the impact of the pandemic, the economic impact, is going to make things worse and is going to hurt a lot of working people. So they've established the Chatham Coronavirus Impact Fund to help those local working people who are financially impacted. And they're working with Monomoy Community Services, which is a local nonprofit, and the Lower Cape Outreach Council, which has a process already in place to review and vet applicants. Now, the fund is specifically designed to provide assistance with housing security, paying rent and mortgage, and bills like utilities, medical costs, vehicle repairs. The way it's going to work is that payments, once approved, will go right to a vendor, a bank, a landlord, or whatever. And they won't be, it won't be cash dispersions to the applicants. And the amounts will be limited, initially at least, to $400 for individuals and $800 for families. And the group's fundraising goal right now is $300,000. And as of later this week, right now, they've raised more than half of that. They have about $170,000. They got a sizable donation earlier this week. And they've got a board of directors and a number of other advisors who are helping direct this to make sure that it gets to the right people.
I want to ask you about another initiative going on in town, and that's has to do with helping local shell fishermen and putting them back to work.
Yeah, you know, the closure of restaurants basically shut down the town's $2.5 million commercial shellfish industry. It's one of the largest on the Cape and even in the state. And to try to get at least a few shell fishermen back to work, there's a local restaurant called Hangar B, which started buying quahogs to make chowder. And it's making that chowder available for free to local families and seniors. They're also selling it to their regular customers to help subsidize the program. They're working with George's Fish Market in Harwich to be their sort of the brick and mortar facility that has the permits to buy the shellfish wholesale and basically turn it around and get it to the restaurants. And Hangar B is working right now with Monomoy Community Services, we mentioned earlier, to identify people who could use this this great local source of protein. And they're hoping to expand this program to other local restaurants to be able to put even more money back into the pockets of the shell fishermen in town.
Tim, we have just a minute here. Real briefly, I want to mention, ask you about Harwich reversing its decision this week to release information on virus infection.
Sure. The Harwich Health Director, Megan Eldridge, had been sort of reluctant to release those figures because the state, if you remember, the State Department of Public Health had kind of recommended that towns not do that. They reversed that position, but Eldridge didn't want to change her position until she got some direction from the Board of Selectmen. And earlier this week, the Harwich Board of Selectmen basically said, you know, we think you should release those numbers. Almost every other town in the Cape is now releasing the number of infected residents. And so they did that. About 25 Harwich residents as of early this week had been diagnosed with coronavirus. There's one fatality, which we wrote about a couple weeks ago, and that person had worked at Allen Harbor Marine. And last week we also learned that a second worker there had died, and this person was an off-Cape resident, so wasn't included in the town's figures. But that was a sad incident as well.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. Take care.
COVID-19 has claimed a Wellfleet man. Bruce Drucker was a longtime member of the zoning board and a big presence in town. From the Provincetown Independent, we're joined now by Casey Myers with the story. Hi, Casey.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Casey, tell us about Bruce Drucker.
All right. Bruce was quite a well-known man. He retired from being a partner in the law firm Rafkin and Radler in New York City. He retired at the age of 55, 20 years ago, moved to Wellfleet full-time with his wife, Claudia, and they were just a really big presence in town, and he was on the Zoning Board of Appeals, like you said, and was the second confirmed death from COVID-19 on the Outer Cape. John Peroni of Provincetown died at the age of 70, died on April 5th, 2 days earlier. And Ed Miller, the editor of the paper, wrote a beautiful obituary about him this week, which kind of not only laid out how brilliant he was, how he was really a cornerstone to the Zoning Board of Appeals, but Ed also kind of went through the timeline of how he got sick and died. And it's very haunting and really hard to understand.
It happened very, very quickly, it seems. It happened very, very quickly.
In a way, it did, and in a way, it didn't. I mean, he got back from a long trip to Brazil with his wife in early February, and he became like the town crier about getting the word out about the coronavirus. He took it really seriously all through March when it started to be a topic of conversation. He was really like, take it seriously. So then at the end of March, you know, almost a month after he returned, he himself became sick. He stayed at home for a week. On March 27th, he was bad enough to get a drive-through test. On March 30th, which was, you know, 3 days later on Monday, he was very, very sick, coughing, shaking, looked awful. His eyes were very red. Next day, a rescue squad took him to Cape Cod Hospital. And at 4 p.m. that night, he texted his wife, Claudia, to say, they were going to intubate him and put him on a ventilator, mm-hmm. and he really just crashed at that point. And on April 7th, now once again, a week later, Cape Cod Hospital called Claudia, who was his wife of 52 years, to say that his condition was very grave. And they allowed her to go in and spend the last half hour of his life with him, which was really great, because you hear so many stories about people dying alone in the hospital with their loved ones barred from coming in to see them. But Cape Cod Hospital was wonderful. She said that the security guard was expecting her. And so, you know, at least she got to see him but at the end of his life.
The obituary you have in The Independent by Ed Miller is just wonderful. It really focuses on so much of the contributions that Bruce made for the town and what a part of the town he was. It's a really nice piece. I encourage people to go look at it. It's Casey Myers from the Provincetown Independent. Casey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Governor Baker came to Cape Cod this week. He came to tour the new field hospital being put together at the Joint Base. Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times has that story for us. Hiya, Cindy.
Good morning.
Cindy, tell us about what the governor saw at the base.
Yeah, the governor came out to the base with the lieutenant governor and toured the facility. This is an old gym that has been converted into this hospital. It's called a field hospital. It's one of several in the state. And it's got rows and rows of beds. They all have mattresses, navy blue covers, you know, not real thick mattresses, but mattresses, two pillows. Each unit has a hospital table, and they have, it appears that laptops have been assigned to each bed, each little, and it's all separated. It's this is a gym, so when you have these privacy curtains, you know, they go sky high up to the big gym ceiling, navy blue sky high curtains, and lots of laptops using electronic medical records. They said they'll have laboratory facilities, pharmacy, everything they need to take care of these patients.
One of the other things that's happening here is that they're opening these step down facilities, which are at two different nursing homes on the Cape, where they'll also be essentially taking overflow patients or patients who don't need that intensive care anymore. And the governor was talking about that, too.
Right. And also, I want to make a point that the Field Hospital at Joint Base Cape Cod is also a step-down facility. These won't be, they're not planning to use it for ICU patients. They're planning it to use it for patients who have been hospitalized and are too sick to go home. And if there's a surge, they want to be able to, they want to have the capacity to take care of them somewhere. And the other locations they mentioned are nursing homes. And one is Wingate at Brewster, which was an empty nursing home. It closed last winter. And then January of 2019. And then also the Falmouth Royal facility, which is on Main Street. And those residents were just recently moved over to the Royal Falmouth Nursing and Rehabilitation. And those residents were just recently moved over to a new location on Jones Road and next to the Morris Pond School. And that freed up about 80 beds for this step down facility.
Now, the governor was asked, he had a press conference after touring the facility, and Michael Lauf of Cape Cod Healthcare also spoke, and they were asked a number of questions about what the state is doing in terms of how things are going forward. Tell us a little bit about what the governor said.
Well, and this is actually, and this is a joint project. This is Cape Cod Healthcare is going to be running these step-down units, and they will be employing Cape Cod Healthcare staff and also augmenting staff. And this is if they're needed, as Mike Loft said, has repeatedly said that he's the CEO of Cape Cod Healthcare, that they are preparing for the worst and hoping for the best. So also the emergency management people have been involved in this, and also the National Guard, of course, has been involved in the Joint Base Cape Cod. And they're expecting the surge to happen. The governor is using epidemiological models that predict the surge will be this Monday, actually, pinpointed this Monday. Other models, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, says Massachusetts should surge about April 27th. On the Barnstable County level, some models have shown that the numbers are actually trending downward and may be peaking earlier. But these things are all very, they could change. This is a virus. It's a natural phenomenon. Nobody really knows. You know, it's a new virus. Nobody really knows its path. And also human behavior can affect it because, you know, this depends upon a lot of social distancing and people staying at home and people washing their hands. And so human behavior will also, you know, have some effect on peak periods.
Mm. Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, thanks for joining us this morning.
Oh, you're welcome. One other thing is I just want to mention, once a peak has passed, it doesn't mean the pandemic is over. The pandemic is still here. People will still be getting sick and in some cases, unfortunately, dying. So when we're talking about the peaks, we're not talking about once the peak has passed, it doesn't mean the pandemic is over.
That is a good thing to keep in mind. We are going to be dealing with this for a long time to come. Cindy, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
A homeless shelter in New Bedford has been on lockdown for more than 3 weeks. Jack Spillane from the Standard Times has that story for us. Hiya, Jack.
Hi, Steve. How are you today?
I'm well, Jack. Jack, this is a revealing look inside the shelter. And one of the things that struck me is that it sounds like there's a lot of camaraderie there.
Yes, it's sort of an out-of-the-way shelter. It's a shelter that specializes in substance abuse cases. And it's unlike the larger shelter in New Bedford, it's sort of out of the beaten path. And like many of our stories, our great photographer Peter Pereira came upon it and discovered that in the wake of the pandemic, they are not letting people come and go. So what if you were there at the beginning of the shutdown a month ago, you are still there. If you leave, you cannot come back to the shelter. Because this shelter is so well known for catering to people with these issues, many people did not want to leave, and they've been struggling through. And Peter got wonderful access to the facility, and you can see the way that people are living in this open area. It's sort of a warehouse, and they have cubicles set off. It's a very touching story. There was one woman who was working as a cook for them, and when they went into shutdown, she moved in herself because she realized they would not have a professional cook to work for them during this quarantine.
Tell us a little bit more about the different people that are there, because it really seems like they have had to form a, as you can imagine, if you're sort of shut down within that facility, an even tighter-knit community to support each other.
Yes, Reverend Bob Hughes, the facility's director, has worked with them. You know, I'm not recalling some of the personal stories off the top of my head, but I know there was one woman who has her dog Bowser with her, and I know others have been, talking about, how they have bonded. There's a lot of laughter that goes on in the community, game playing, the kind of things where people, locked in unfortunate circumstances begin to support each other better and come to know each other. You would think that it would be a bleak environment, but the story by Kieran Dunlop shows that it's just the opposite. People have really adapted to it.
It's a really nice story. Jack Spillane from the Standard Times joins us with that. Jack, thank you for that this morning.
Very good.
This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. Martha's Vineyard towns are wrestling with whether to extend a construction ban. It's created some heated feeling on both sides. Reporter Noah Asimo takes a look at that in the Vineyard Gazette, and he joins us now. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, a teleconference on Wednesday brought together the key players here, and it sounds like it was tense at times. Tell us about that conversation and what this is, how this is shaping up.
It was. It was tense and it was emotional, and it was 90 minutes of pretty much all the sort of, a lot of, mainly, if you were an influential political figure on the island, you were pretty much on the conference call. But it was all started basically by this 11th hour email from the hospital CEO, Denise Schiappici, that said, the towns were planning to relax or at least institute these guidelines that would allow 1- and 2-man crews to get back to the job. The towns on the island have instituted these really strict construction bans. And sort of part of the deal was that they would institute guidelines when they initially enacted them that would help get people or slowly, gradually get people back on job sites. But the hospital CEO sent an email almost right before they were set to vote that said, relaxing any sort of construction restriction would be just a dire mistake. And in the conference call on Wednesday, so the towns, they tabled their votes, then they had this conference call on Wednesday, and she pretty much reiterated her claim and sort of entrenched herself in her position and the towns. And I guess the police sort of split the island in half in a way that, I'd never really seen before. It was kind of remarkable, and it was emotional. And there was fire on both sides, really.
One of the things they're talking about here is extending it, or she's asking them to extend it and
right.
not to consider breaking this down yet.
Right. I think her point is that she wants the construction ban, strict one, to extend until April 28th at a minimum. And the argument there is that, according to epidemiologists throughout the state, the surge in Boston is expected to happen on April 20th. So the towns that wanted to institute these relaxing guidelines by April 22nd, her feeling is it's too soon to when the peak is going to happen in Boston. People still come up from Boston. That still leaves the island at risk. She said multiple times we're not as remote as people think we are. And so really she wants to buy another week. Her argument is we're going to know more by April 28th. this is only one more week. People already aren't working. And a lot of the up island towns on the island agreed with her. They said, hey, we're working on these guidelines, but we haven't even circulated them to the construction community yet. So they wouldn't even really know about them or be able to sort of follow through on them by the 22nd regardless. But the down island towns, they were adamant on the 22nd, and they sort of stood by that.
So and, where does that where does that leave things then as they're trying to figure this out?
Right. It's a tricky thing because the down island towns, their argument was basically that as it stands, the really strict construction bans are difficult to enforce, according to them, because you have to enforce everything. You have to enforce one and two man work crews that are working or even the larger violations. But their feeling is that if they were to restrict if they were to relax the construction guidelines a little bit, they could then focus on enforcing the bigger violators. But as it stood after the meeting, there was really no compromise, and that was somewhat remarkable considering State Senator Julian Sear was on the call. He made this sort of desperate pitch for island unity. It didn't really pan out to anything, and the towns were split. But what I suspect is that there is work happening behind the scenes to sort of come together on this. I'm not sure if the date's going to be the 22nd, the 28th. Maybe somewhere in between. That was an idea that was floated in the meeting. But I would suspect that something like that will happen. I would be surprised if towns all voted on different dates to do this, just because it really is such an important issue island-wide that, maybe they will. I suspect they probably will be able to come to terms on something. But at the meeting on Wednesday, it sure didn't seem like it.
It was interesting, the comments under the article that you have on the Vineyard Gazette, there's a lot of comments, and you really get a sense of the heat in the community even discussing this issue.
Right, I know. I mean, it's not something it's not just heated among the town officials. It's something that, is probably even more fiery within the community. And I think the issues that are being discussed within the community are slightly different than the ones that town officials are discussing. You know, people, they're not the ones who need to go back to work necessarily. These are people who are really sort of weighing their livelihoods versus fighting a pandemic and sort of the island's particular limitations and resources with regards to how they can fight it. And it's clear that there's a total range in how people feel about this, which is, on the one hand, it makes it really an exciting and interesting thing to cover, but also it's serious and people are they really care and they're passionate about it. And I think the economic argument is one that sort of you see more in the comment section on the website than you do when the town officials are discussing it. Because, even the down island towns that wanted to institute the relaxations by the 22nd, I think part of that was economic and pressure from builders who need to get back to work. But a lot of it was also sort of from their end on the enforcement side. You know, we need to do this for our own sort of public safety bandwidth sake, which was an interesting difference, I thought.
That is Noah Asmo reporting in the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, thank you.
Governor Baker may be managing the state's response to the coronavirus crisis, but he still needs lawmakers' approval for a number of changes he wants to see get made. On top of that, Democrats are struggling to compromise on a number of bills, and basically they need to rewrite the upcoming state budget. WCAI's Catherine Ident talked with our State House reporter Mike Dean and has this report.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
Mike, before we get to some of the other items that have happened on Beacon Hill's agenda this week, I wanted to briefly talk about this new town-by-town data on COVID-19 that the state has started releasing, and that's letting the public see for the first time how the virus is spreading around Massachusetts.
Yeah, DPH has changed its policy from giving out data on a county basis to now doing it on municipality by municipality. Of course, that gives us a much clearer idea of where the disease is, where there are spikes and hotspots, and where it's a little bit under the state average. And you're kind of seeing, of course, more urban areas have higher rates than rural ones. One of the problems and one of the complaints that we heard most often with the county by county data is that, take something like Middlesex County, you you can't really tell what's a case that's in Cambridge or Somerville versus what's in Lowell, because the county is so large and kind of geographically, you know, Barnstable County is another good example of the geographic range of different things. Of course, the islands as well. So giving it town by town is going to let people know a lot more about where these hot spots are. The state hadn't been doing that because they feared that there could be kind of anxiety or fear or even a violation of patients' privacy if they put out that kind of data in the early stages when there weren't that many cases in Massachusetts. If there were only a handful, it could be easier to figure out who those people were. Now that the data set's larger, there are far more cases. They say that it is better for the public and for those town officials to be able to be public with that info.
And I think it's interesting what state officials are saying. As the public sees hotspots, but also places where there are fewer reported cases, to not get complacent. So first it was panic, but now it's there are far more cases likely than what we have testing capacity for. And so I think it's interesting that they've changed their message a little bit that way.
Precisely, yeah.
I want to switch now to the budget, which in a non-pandemic time, we would be following this pretty closely. Of course, this time around, the budget is a totally different animal for lawmakers. They had a virtual hearing this week to talk about it, and the testimony was pretty grim.
Yeah, dire situation for the state budget. This was the first real economic roundtable budget hearing between the Ways and Means chairman from the House and the Senate and the ANF secretary, the budget secretary from the Baker administration. The three of them were in the State House, but they had a teleconference with budget experts and economists from around the state. And, you know, it wasn't unanimous, but pretty much everybody, all these experts said that we're looking at a budget shortfall between $4 and $6 billion, not only because of the immediate business closures and the revenue downturn that's going to happen in the months of quarantine that we're seeing, but then the recession that's likely going to be triggered by this crisis. So that's going to shave 14 to 16% off of tax revenue right off the bat. And that really means rewriting a $40 billion budget without $4.5 to $5 billion that you expected to have. The discretionary portion of the state budget is not that big. So this is going to be a wholesale rewrite of what the spending plans were. It's putting a lot of things in question, like education funding, health funding. We're spending a lot more on public health and the unemployment system. So this is the task that lawmakers now have in front of them between now and July, when the new fiscal year supposedly starts.
There's been talk of how healthy the state's rainy day fund is. In fact, it's one of the healthiest rainy day funds in the country. Does the governor and do lawmakers want to dip into that now to kind of help them through the hurdle here?
Some people do. There wasn't as much talk when it comes to economists about that. Suggestions are to use a few million here, a few, tens or hundreds of million here and there. Now, a $3.5 billion rainy day fund isn't going to do too much for a $4.5 billion budget hole. It'll fill most of it, but then you're done. You don't have anything to prepare for the recession that's going to come after all of this. And that's what the rainy day fund is really for. It's for a long-term filling in the gaps when it comes to a recession rather than a one-time emergency. So I think that you're going to see a lot more spending cuts in this budget to make up for that budget hole and not necessarily drain the entirety of that rainy day fund.
And it sounds kind of like we'll be going back to budget numbers that we saw a few years ago, because the state budget usually increases a little every year.
Yeah, of course. You know, it was 2010, the budget that really, FY 2010, that really took the brunt of the recession 11 years ago. And so we're kind of going back to those tough times where we're going to see state services really slashed in a lot of ways, potentially.
And that's WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking to us from Boston. Mike, get some rest this weekend if you can.
Will do. Thanks.
And that was WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean there. You're listening to the Local News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. It has been a challenge to get a clear picture of how the coronavirus is impacting the region. The state reports numbers by county each day and has just started putting out weekly town numbers. A new Capewide tool out this week could make things easier for people to see what's happening where they are. WCAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us now to explain. Hiya, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve. Good morning.
Good morning. This is an online map, Jeanette. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so it's a heat map, which just means areas are color-coded by the intensity of something, in this case, COVID-19 cases. And there are two layers of data you can click on when you go there. One, you click on, you see cases divided by Upper Cape, Mid Cape, Lower, and Outer Cape. And the more detailed one is by zip code. So you can click on each area and see total cases and new cases. The map is on three different websites because those are the organizations that are collaborating to work on it. That's Cape Cod Healthcare, the Cape Cod Commission, and Barnstable County.
You also had a chance to talk to a doctor from Cape Cod Healthcare a little bit about the map and then what data it shows and how it can be used. Tell us about that conversation.
Yes, that was with Dr. Kumara Siddhartha from Cape Cod Healthcare. He said the new cases by zip code really show the trend. So essentially, of course, the virus is looking to catch someone unaware, and they want to be able to make people more aware of where cases are increasing so they can take precautions. For example, when I looked at the data first thing this morning, it said there were 5 new cases in South Dennis. So you can see that it's spreading a little faster there right now, even though the total number of cases in South Dennis is really not unusually high.
We have a link to this map on our website, and it really is fascinating to be able to look at not just by towns, but as you say, to click into the zip codes and see, you know, sections of towns and how they're reporting. You can spend a lot of time clicking around the region, it feels like.
Right, yeah.
You did another story this week I want to ask you about, and this was looking at how local businesses are trying to cope with the pandemic situation, particularly those that are dependent on the summer economy.
Yeah, I spoke to Wendy Northcross from the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, and she, of course, has her her finger really on the pulse of what's happening with that. She says businesses are trying to predict, of course, how much business they're going to do this season, but that's really difficult because they don't know when they're going to be able to open. But decisions need to be made now or need to be made ahead of their opening about hiring, supplies, and everything else. She's also concerned that the...
Yep, and Jeanette, are you here with us again, Jeanette?
I am back on the line, yes, sorry.
Thanks, no worries. Jeanette, I just wanted to ask you quickly also about how we had heard that some businesses already canceled for the season. Is that right?
Right. So as far as I know, there is a sort of bar and restaurant in Provincetown that has already announced their closing. Wendy says that's not the norm so far. She's not seeing a trend in that direction yet. But she did talk a little bit about how difficult it is for hotels and venues because they can't just sort of save inventory and sell it later. That their inventory are the rooms and things that they sell at each night, and that can't really be made up. But she says they're doing the best they can to push bookings out later in the year instead of canceling them.
I thought one of the interesting ideas that Wendy Northcross had here had to do with health inspectors.
Right. So she and some of the businesses, she says, are concerned that particularly if they're like a seasonal business that needs to be inspected each time it opens for the season, that there could be a crush of businesses trying to get inspected, and that could cause delays for the businesses. She says she's looking into the idea of one town's inspectors helping another town if there's more capacity there.
That is WCAI's Jeanette Barnes joining us this morning. Jeanette, thank you for that.
Thanks.
And that is our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from WCAI Sam Houghton, Eve Zuckoff, and Jeanette Barnes. We spoke with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent. We checked in with Cindy McCormick at the Cape Cod Times, Jack Spillane at the Standard Times, Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette, and of course we heard from Mike Dean up at the State House speaking with Catherine Ident. A big thanks to Dan Treidle back at the studio for running the board, and thank you to my family for not raising a ruckus while we're on the air. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.